AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 66 for August 5th, 2010. Joy to the world. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine After Hours in the iTunes Store. And joining me as always, the auto extremist is here. Great having you here, Peter.
John, glad to be here.
And I got to really thank you for filling in for me on AutoLine Daily. I thought you did a terrific job. And I'm not just saying it because you're here. I mean, my wife and I were driving down from Traverse City at the big management briefing seminars conference yesterday, and I wanted to see desperately, how did the show go? And it was like, through Stitcher, through my phone. And I did the very thing that I've been telling everybody else here to do.
That's cool.
And I thought you did a great delivery, and we'll... We've already got some comments about your editorial that you did, really looking at how well the SUV segment and the Ford Explorer in general has really served the market.
Yeah. Good. Let's get at it.
And also joining us tonight is Jeff Green from Bloomberg, and it's great having you here, too. You've been on before, but it's...
Usually you aren't here.
I haven't been here when you are, so it's good to have you here, too, Jeff. And then... Joining us later in the show, once we get through some of the news of the week, is Tom Kovaleski, the Vice President of Corporate Communications for BMW North America. And another thing that I want to mention, too, before we get into the news, is that in 2 weeks' time, we're going to be doing AutoLine After Hours from the Woodward Dream Cruise. But we're bumping it up one night. We got a fantastic location, but we couldn't get it for Thursday night, August 19th. So we're moving it up to Wednesday. That one night, we'll cover the Woodward Dream Cruise from Woodward Avenue. We're going to go from 6 to 8 p.m. We're going to be at a building called the Balmoral Center that's at Normandy and Woodward, or I think that's about 14 and a half mile. Is that right,
Norman? No, it's 13.
13 and a half mile. And it's a great location. We can actually accommodate a lot of cars. If you'd like to come and visit us as we do our live webcast, we'd more than welcome you. If you'd like to bring a car, let us know, because we logistically there are some issues, but we can make it happen. Send us an email at viewermail@autolinedetroit.tv, and we'd love to try to make that happen. And also, we're still open for sponsors on that show, and if you'd like to get your marketing message in front of many thousands of industry and automotive enthusiasts, let us know. We'd like to help that. But let's get to some of the news that happened this week, and I guess the big one was what kicked it all off was the July sales, and Peter, looks like it's still a weak market. The numbers weren't all that good.
Yeah, I think it's going to be like this one more month, too, and before we really start to get the momentum going. But, you know, it was better than a year ago. So,
yeah.
Of course, anything was better than a year ago, but there's still encouraging signs in what's going on.
No, absolutely. There were some encouraging signs. I mean, if I were Chrysler, for example, the new Jeep Grand Cherokee is just bolted out of the gates. It's like doubled what it did a year ago and was up substantially from a year ago last month.
Ford Fiesta.
Fiesta is starting to catch on quick.
The new models are going to start to take over, I think.
We took a much dimmer view. And, I mean, I think the adjusted SAR kind of bore that out. This was supposed to be the strongest month of the year. Rate-wise, ended up being the third strongest, not even the second strongest. March and May were both better months sales rate-wise than this month. So clearly, I think J.D. Power said the first half looked really good, and then it started to peter out as the month.
First half of the month.
Yeah, the second half of the month really started to look a little weaker. And you kind of look for, and obviously comparison to next month is going to be bad because of cash for clunkers, so it's pretty much pointless to to get anything off of that beyond maybe the rate. But it's just doesn't feel like a recovery still. It feels a lot like what we've been hearing for the last couple of years. Just wait till the second half and you'll see. And it just doesn't feel like.
Yeah, I'm looking at the SAR as reported by Ward's, 11.5 million. And everyone was talking about
11.9,
12, maybe over 12.
Yeah, J.D. Power said 12 even with a slow finish, I think, right in that range, yeah.
So what else did you see in the sales there, Jeff? Anything else?
Well, I mean, the truck strength is really interesting.
Trucks are doing better than cars.
If you're buying what they're saying, that it's finally got to the point where no matter what your confidence level is or whatever, you reach, in some cases, you're reaching capitulation. Ford's economist was on their call saying, people just have finally reached the point they don't have any choice. And another thing you got going is used car prices are so strong that it's not the alternative it used to be. I didn't check. I meant to actually check this. You could probably rent. In some cases, it would cost you more to buy a used car than to buy a new car now.
In certain models. Yeah, I've read about that, which is astonishing.
So you're kind of stuck at some point. Your car's going to stop running, and somebody's got to buy a new one. And we seem to be reaching some of that point. So, I mean, that's sort of good news, but it's not the reason you want to hear I'm buying a car.
Yeah, but I think the new vehicles eventually are just going to take over. And you're right, people are forced to buy new, and I think they're going to go to the new products, the Grand Cherokee, the Fiesta, the new Edge, which is flying under the radar screen, which is a very nice redo, then eventually the Explorer. And I think the new products are going to take over.
Yeah, I think they will, or certainly of what's being sold, the new stuff is going to sell the best, yeah. as it typically does. What do you guys make of this announcement that Hyundai made this week at the management briefing?
50 miles per gallon?
Yeah, that they are going to have a fleet average of 50 miles per gallon by 2025, I think.
Well, I've always thought that, rather than fool around with another batch of CAFE standards, if the administration, I don't care which administration in Washington, really wanted to do something, they would have labeled it as a moonshot. They would have said, which Krafchick said, he said, I admit it's a bit of a moonshot. No, it's a whole big moonshot. I mean, it's a Mars shot. But I wish our administration would have approached it that way. We need to put our stake in the ground, and we're gonna figure this out, and we're gonna devote our resources and technologies and ability to figure this out, and we're going to put a obscenely high goal on there. Like when Kennedy said, we're going to put a man on the moon in 9 years from now, whenever he made that speech, and everyone said, huh? So I applaud Krafchick for doing it. I'm not so sure Hyundai is going to do it or get close, but, I think it was a noble way to go about it.
And the least crazy company, at least crazy person to say it is either Hyundai or Honda. No body on frame vehicles. They've got the lineup. You put a stop start system on all your vehicles, like GM was going to do with a lithium ion battery. You go for high hybrid concentration with a mild hybrid, and you don't have the big trucks. And they're clearly not going to go there. So if anybody,
it's a whole lot easier for Hyundai to meet that goal.
And Honda's got to be kicking themselves. First, Hyundai took away the title of most fuel efficient. Ironically, Honda's defense is they're not a full line manufacturer, and now they jump out and make this audacious claim that 2025 is a long time from now, and that's going to be the Hyundai Motors, which is trying to get 50 miles per gallon by 2025, something, 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 sort of like Ford with the only automaker not to take a government bailout. That becomes their identity. And, what's Honda got now? It was genius, actually, for
Hyundai to do that.
Yeah, it was genius, but it's just like, you're right, it's a long way away.
Well, it also creates a couple of interesting things, because a lot of CAFE proponents, people who really have said all along that, geez, what we put on the books is way too easy for the industry, this 35.5 is nothing, we got to plant the flag at 50 miles per gallon. Nancy Pelosi has talked about this in the House of Representatives, so there's a lot of political weight behind making that happen. So I don't know what Hyundai's done here. Now they've said, 50 miles per gallon. I'm sure everybody else in the industry would love to just wring their necks for having said it.
Yeah.
But what's also interesting is they moved the goal yards. Hyundai didn't say by 2020. They said by 2025. So on the other hand, maybe they've added a little bit more realism into the discussion.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, Kravchuk was just making headlines up in Traverse City. So, you know.
Well, speaking of headlines and fuel economy, Tim Magnaniello, who is the CEO of BorgWarner, made some headlines, too, by saying, don't forget about diesel engines. Why are we as a government pouring all this money into electrics and hybrids? Well, you know, we're cutting out diesels. And he put some very powerful arguments out there that if only one-third of the car market in the United States was diesel, we could save over a billion barrels a day.
Yeah, I don't get it either. And I know Tom, you know, represents BMW, has some magnificent diesels, and Mercedes, and there are great diesels out there. And I think as a transition, I can't believe our government hasn't stepped in and encouraged more people. And
well, we had a story today saying GM's looking at diesels in cars. I mean, it's one of the things they're considering.
That's a big story, I think.
Among many things. It was kind of buried in the story among the 60 different sort of product things that they're looking at. But diesels in cars, I mean, it's something that even if GM's looking at, clearly they have diesels elsewhere.
Sure. I think it's a missed opportunity, clearly.
I got to dig this up, but I got an email today. I don't know if I can put my hands on it right quick enough, but there's a bunch of governors and mayors coming out decrying how strict American diesel emission standards are, that if we would just back off a little bit, even to Europe standards, which are no walk in the park, but American standards are so much more costly to meet. That's why we don't have diesels in this country like they do in Europe.
You got to convince those people that live in that valley in California. I mean, that's where, you know, we were headed for a diesel, 85 mile per gallon diesel hybrid car, passenger car under PNGV. And then the administration at that time said, oh, but you can't use a diesel. And everybody said, well, then forget it. And then CARB came out and said, diesel's a carcinogen. It kills people.
Yeah, well, we're missing an opportunity to save a lot of barrels of oil. Plus, so maybe we should start just building that wall, you know, just wall off California and say, you guys have at it, figure it out, drive your shiny, happy, smiley cars and your bikes, and we'll be done with it.
I saw one thing up at the management briefing seminars that intrigued me. It's a company, local company here in Michigan, called Protean Electric, that have come up with a design for an electric motor that builds right into the hub of the wheel. And it's a modular design made out of a bunch of little pieces so that they can be assembled by very simple automation, what they call pick-and-place robots, very inexpensive stuff. Because their idea is, we don't want to design something and end up seeing it made in China. So why don't we do really good design for manufacturing, design for assembly, use very simple automation, and keep the manufacturing here? But anyway, long story short is they took a Ford F-250, ripped out the engine and the transmission, ripped out the differential, the drive shaft, the axles, and everything like that, put hub motors in the wheels. I was driving around up north there in this thing. And their idea is, oh, and I should add, a guy named Bob Purcell, who was very high in GM's electric vehicle, advanced vehicle program, he's on the board of this company. That's how I got interested in them. His idea is to get the enthusiast crowd interested in this. So you take a Camaro or a Mustang, you literally just bolt in two hub motors on the back wheels, put in a battery pack in the trunk, and now you have 200 horsepower more at the wheels. 200 more. And his point was, John, if you wanted to go in and modify an engine to get an additional 200 horsepower, you're talking, you know, massive blowers, all this other kind of very expensive. So it's the first time I've seen anybody coming out of the EV field really thinking, you know, unlike Tesla, they've got a cool thing with their Roadster. It's very quick and all that sort of stuff. But here's a low-cost way of literally just bolting 200 horsepower onto your car. And I don't know what the weight would do from a handling standpoint, but from a drag racing standpoint, it would be awesome.
You know, I don't think a lot of people realize just how much power there is in an electric drive system. And it was 1997, they had Future Car Challenge or something like that out at Ford, and I was in a old Ford Taurus that the kids from UC Berkeley converted into a hybrid electric car. And so, you know, a bunch of batteries in the trunk. That was pretty, you know, they built it themselves, but they took you out and let, you know, go a quarter mile. And it was, you know, silent and way better than the car I was driving at the time. Just, you know, you're just gone. And that was, you know, not anywhere near sophisticated as what we have now.
Well, again, that's the beauty of an electric motor is you get instant torque.
Yeah, it was... If you haven't ever, you know, you just assume it's going to be like a golf cart with a limiter and.
Well, one of the other ideas that Protean has is you take a front-wheel drive car, put these hub motors on the back wheels, and now you've got a hybrid. You've got all-wheel drive, or you can go pure electric, or you use the electric to accelerate and then click on the engine and drive it. So, and they're not the first ones to think about doing something like that. But again, these hub motors are intriguing because you can get rid of the axle and the differential.
Isn't that what Audi's doing with their version?
I think you're right. With the e-tron, I think, is in hub motors.
And Magna bought that company that was based out here in Sterling Heights or in Rochester Hills. Brought it. That's working on some of Ford's projects. That's one of the things they did. It was a lot. It was motors at the hubs.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing. It was. I forget who. It was a couple Russians and some American generals put this company together with Russian military technology, and it was slow going. So it went through a bunch of owners, but Magna ended up bringing it in house, and that's sort of been sort of the germ of their electric program that they're doing with Ford right now. Same idea, hub motors.
Well, the hub motors things are fascinating because now you can really configure a car in a different way. The thing that amazed me was when I popped the hood on this F-250 where they had yanked out the engine and everything. It's a monstrously big engine compartment. You don't realize it until the engine's out of there. You go, oh, my God, I could live in that place. And so you could easily chop 2 to 3 feet off the nose of the vehicle, still leave enough crush for safety, add that to the bed, you know, the length of the bed, and not increase the overall length of the truck. And another thing that you could do with the hub motors is once you eliminate the differential and the axle shafts is you can drop the floor of the bed by a foot, maybe more. And so now you start to do some interesting things. And when you think you control each four hubs separately, you have the ultimate in traction control, ABS, stability control, all that sort of stuff.
Do they have manufacturers?
They have. Well, Ford gave them the truck to do.
Oh.
And I think they're taking it to SEMA as well. Or maybe they took it to SEMA. I can't remember now. So that ought to tell you something. You know, when automakers give vehicles to different groups to do, it's because they know there's enough there to say, yeah, here, take something and go play around with it. One other thing that we ought to cover in the news, too, is Toyota's profit. And I know, Jeff, you guys looked into this. They surprised a lot of people who thought because of all the recalls and the lawsuits and the quality issues that they've had that Toyota wouldn't make that good of money, but it looks like they did pretty good, and it looks like most of it came out of North America, and most of that came out of their finance arm.
I was going to say the key thing is it's a finance. I mean, that's the old GM way of making money, you know, sort of ironically and yet appropriately, is to make money from your bank as much as, you know, when you can't make money from your car company. And or, I mean, I guess they still made money, but Toyota has neglected their finance unit. Because they could for a long time, they would sort of poo-poo the idea of a finance unit as a profit center and a cash generator. It was just some a service for their customers. I think this shows, you know, they're sort of in sort of that realistic situation where your finance unit is sort of your smoother. You know, it clearly they're still selling vehicles, and clearly somebody still has to finance them. And
the other thing I found kind of amusing, really, was that one of the ways the finance unit made so much money is that because residuals for used cars are so much higher than everyone expected, anytime they had to go and repossess a vehicle, they were able to sell it at a higher level than what the predicted loss rate was going to be. And that's where this finance unit made a significant chunk of profit.
Well, look at Ally/GMAC. I mean, they're having a really good run right now, too. And, I mean, yeah, this used car value situation is changing. I mean, bottom line is, for the first time in a long time, we're kind of looking at a pull instead of a push, and it does change everything. And, you know,
everything.
Yeah, I mean, it's taken a while to kind of look up and go, this is not the same old auto industry.
No, it's dramatic. The last 12 months have changed this industry for a long time to come. A long time to come.
I wasn't surprised in Toyota making money because they will make money in a lot of it. The interesting thing is their marketing and advertising costs went up 400%.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So that's how they're trying to get sales going.
Well, and Honda actually had a bigger profit than Toyota, so.
By a significant margin. I think they did $2.7 billion, Toyota.
And what? You got to wonder, though, they had a really bad month, and their incentives, if AutoData got it right, their incentives went up substantially.
Ooh. Honda.
They had a bad month, so you're looking forward, maybe this won't hold, but they didn't have a great July, and they really threw money at their cars, too, so there's, you know.
Toyota did throw money at it, and they actually had a pretty good month. If you look at month over month,
right,
which is what I'm focusing on more these days. Well, hey, let's bring in our guest for the show today. We've got Tom Kovaleski joining us, the Vice President of Corporate Communications for BMW North America. Just step over the dog. He won't hurt you, Tom. Come on and join us here.
Maybe he was the other guest tonight. He's brought some real intelligence on.
And put your mic on, too. Because we need people to be able to hear what you're saying here. And I introduced you or promoted the fact that you were coming on today's show, mentioning that you're with BMW, have been in the past at a variety of other automakers, including General Motors, Chrysler, Renault, because when I first met you, you were with Renault. Mm-hmm. And I said, I think American Motors, but I wasn't sure if you had been at...
Yeah, that was another merger.
You've been through a few mergers.
Three mergers.
Oh, my gosh.
And three mergers and one divorce. Well, maybe two divorces.
And you're not talking
no,
your
I'm not
own
talking,
personal
yeah, yeah.
marriage.
I've been lucky right, enough yeah, to yeah. be married for a few years. But
right.
No, that's right. It has been very interesting. You're right. It was, and life sort of comes full circle because now being back in New Jersey at BMW's headquarters... My first job in the car business was in New Jersey, about 15 miles away.
And that was
with Renault. And then we moved to New York, and then Renault started buying bigger and bigger chunks of the old AMC. And so, therefore, AMC became part of our life, and that's how we got to Detroit.
That's yeah. your first merger.
Yep, and then, that's right, and then AMC, when Renault turned around and moved back to Europe, AMC became part of Chrysler, and that was then being at Chrysler for a number of years. And then while working at Chrysler in Europe, running marketing, here comes Daimler, Daimler-Benz, not Daimler AG now, but Daimler-Benz, and that was the third one.
So
very, very interesting.
And then you were there for the divorce.
No, I was gone for the divorce.
What was the divorce then? You said you had a divorce.
Well, actually, I wasn't there for the divorce, but that's uh-huh. right, watching the divorce from afar, yeah. Yeah.
So BMW...
Actually, I was there for one divorce. It wasn't a merger, but I was there for a divorce of type, and that was at General Motors with Fiat.
You guys remember that?
Yeah,
there was a divorce there as well.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
right.
More of a living together relationship.
It was. Yeah. It was. Yeah.
Living in
yeah.
sin.
Yeah. yeah. Unfortunately, they didn't get into computer dating before. I think yes. that was probably the problem.
They probably yeah. should have used a dating yeah. service.
Our viewers should know that Tom's reputation for doing the most magnificent media events ever staged. And... he's been responsible for some of the greatest ones.
What the good old days, Peter, when there was money.
And when there was money. Yeah.
Well, I was one on,
not anymore.
I was on
yeah.
one of the best yeah. ones when yeah. you guys did the Viper GTS intro. And
oh, that was a fun one, yeah.
And because
yeah.
we got to drive at a variety of famous old racetracks, including the original, the old Nürburgring.
Yes.
We went to Spa-Francorchamps.
And yeah. the French track or the ghost track.
Reims.
Yeah.
Reims, as we Americans yeah, Reims, pronounce it.
Reims, Reims.
Right.
Yes.
Which was really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which you can't
you're right.
do.
It's a ghost town.
Which you can't do anymore.
Really?
Yeah.
I
that
Audi
one is,
was the last one who did it just 2 years ago where they yeah. had all their auto unions, and that was the last time.
Way cool.
It was the, let me see if I remember the route. It was route... RN 30, Route Nationale 30, which was the long Thilwa Strait that went down to the Thilwa Hairpin. And that has now two roundabouts in it, so they completely tore up that section. Oh. So you can get to the old tribunes in the pit buildings, but
which
you can't,
are cement.
Yeah,
concrete,
which are cement.
They're going to be there
but
forever.
But you can't do the loop anymore. Yeah. But that was really fun when you could do that. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people would do it then, too.
So, Peter, you're right. Yeah. Tom has put on some pretty good trips.
What's your two or three most memorable events that you like doing?
I think John picked out one. I think that was really a good one.
I didn't go to this one, but the Cadillac Le Mans followed by the meeting in Italy, I didn't go to that one, but I heard it.
Yeah, that was good. That was a good one. I also think, though, the other one was the launch in 1994 of the all-new. You know, there was the first Chrysler minivan, then refreshed in, I think, 90 or 91. And then in 1994... came the all-new minivan, and that was a very good one because it was a chance to, in a sense, reposition the vehicle, which you don't get that opportunity all that often, you know, is to really show a fresh face of the vehicle because several changes. I think that was a seminal change in a vehicle that had been in the market that was being replaced, that others were getting into that segment. So there was a good opportunity to do some really interesting things with that.
So how's it working at BMW versus all the different companies that you've been at?
I would say it's the difference between a domestic company and a European or a German company is pretty large. It's pretty large.
How do you see it? How do you experience it?
I'll give you one quick example. I walked inside a BMW for the first time in May of 2008. And the company is fascinating because in 2000, and I think late 2007, 2008, really shows something very telling about the company. At that point in time, in May of 2008, we had taken 60,000 units out of global production in 2008. Now, remember, Lehman Brothers wasn't until September of 2008. So the company already saw something, was preparing, and in a sense, put a crisis mentality through the whole company. So I walk into BMW, you know, and it took like a day or a day and a half, and you kind of felt like people were in crisis and things are really bad. And your first inclination from where you come from is crisis? You don't know no crisis. You know, let me tell you about crisis. But then after about an hour of that, you think, well, wait a minute. Isn't this the way the companies manage their ways through tough times and times of change? And quite frankly, you know, that was the beginning, I think, of the company really managing its way extremely well through the whole recessionary period of, you know, really seeing things early, buckling down early. And about the only other time in my career I ever saw anything like that was in Chrysler 1988, 1989, down at the Detroit Science, where the Detroit Science Center is, and it was the Detroit... What was it, the Detroit Engineering School at Wayne State University? Lee Iacocca pulled the whole management group together and, in a sense, threw the company in crisis at that period of time. And if you remember, 1989, you know, there were still bonuses and sales were going up. But he saw something happening, which happened in 1990, 1991, that he was already started to prepare the company for. And, you know, those are two times you remember a lot because you also remember a lot of other times where companies miss that. You know, and it just goes by, or else they don't want to get into crisis or tell their employees is that we've got to change significantly before something hits, or maybe, you know, hope springs eternal and there's optimism. So to me, that really kind of set a wonderful tone for the kind of company that BMW is. It was really interesting.
Plus, you get real cool cars to drive, Tom.
That is a nice benefit of it, too. That is a nice
Let's
benefit.
Talk about some of those cars. It's incredible the breadth of product that BMW has these days. I mean, you know, for those of us who remember when it was pretty much the 2002 company, you know, the BMW 2002, to the amazing lineup, I almost think there's too many products out there that they're slicing the market too thin and just going, hey, let's throw this out here and see what happens. And you know, what's gotten the biggest criticism over the last 2 years, of course, is the X6.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you, I mean, I can completely share that kind of perception. But I can also tell you is that this is one company that doesn't just throw anything out there and see what happens. You know, it's really fascinating because maybe I'll put a couple points on the wall here and we can talk about some of these. We are fortunate around the world to have a hugely passionate body of owners and fans. And I don't think many other companies have that. I mean, you know, if you love BMWs, you can't, it's a wall that you just can't get. You're not going to convince anybody otherwise. On the other hand, because of that kind of passion, and passion swings, you know, to one side or the other side, there are those people who won't come close to a BMW as well, you know. But that's what kind of makes a company interesting, because there's always an interest around it. So we have this hugely passionate body of fans of the company. And for them, BMW is their own, which is wonderful. I mean, you know, companies try to create that bond, and we have been fortunate enough to have that for a long time. Therefore, there is a personal feeling about BMW. Don't you tell me, company, what it is. I know what a BMW is because I own a 2002, or else I own an E36, or I also an E60, and I know exactly what I know what BMW is. At the same time, we have to face a reality of continuing to be able to provide the kinds of products that drive that passion. And we want to always do that. And the company has everything on its future plan to continue to do that. But in a day of increasing regulations and increasingly diverse regulations in major markets around the world, Asia, Europe, the Americas, where we sell our vehicles, we've got to stretch and bend a little bit here to kind of meet where we need to be to maintain the profitability, which will maintain the investment and the capital expenditures and the cash flow to kind of do the products that we want to do. So what I hope everybody will start to see is, if BMW to you is a 3 Series or more particularly an M3, don't fear. You know, because we're going to be doing electric vehicles, they aren't all going to be electric BMWs. You know, and in a sense, doing electric vehicles will give us the license to continue to do the core of the brand, the 3, the 5, and the 7. And I would dare say, and maybe this is a good point of discussion here, dare say the X5 has joined that. And if you go back to the early 90s, when the X5 was starting to be planned, was, you know, a gem in the eye of the company, that was heresy as much as an X6 is today, when you think about that. In fact, in Traverse City this week, I ran into one of the senior guys from Global Insight, who was telling me that he runs their consulting business. And he was telling me that he had done some consulting for BMW back in the early 90s because he was the only guy that would take the job when BMW said, we want a little bit of outside thinking about should we do a sport utility vehicle. He said, because everybody else was telling, oh, that's an easy one. That's the last kind of vehicle you'd ever want to do. Well, we come into, you know, fast forward ahead, and we come into July, and that vehicle had 51% sales increase this month. You know, it was our highest sales increase vehicle. It's in great demand around the world. Spartanburg is the plant for the X5 and the X6 for the world. We export about 70% out of Spartanburg, which shows X5 and X6 has great demand around the world. So, you know, it is understandable, you know, in terms of sometimes I think the passion, the perception, and maybe even a little bit of the fear of the real aficionado, which we completely understand. But at the same time, for our company to kind of make its way as an independent company, we've got to grow as well, too, because we don't have a big corporate parent that kind of says, okay, we'll make it on the volume. You guys go do the focus vehicles. I mean, we've got to make it work both ways.
I see the X3 has dramatically improved, too. When is that coming here?
It's going to go into production this fall, around September, and then we'll sell it in Europe. It will go on sale late October, early November in Europe, and we'll get them before the end of the year. But effectively, Peter, on sale date will be January.
And John said you brought pictures of the new, the BMW version of the Mini to show tonight?
No.
Just kidding.
Because there may, you know what, it would have been too many, because there may be more than one.
Oh, okay.
It's one of the things that we are looking at, which is front-wheel drive models with BMW. And, you know, when you take a look at that, that may be a family someday as well, too.
Yeah.
You raised the issue yourself that I think a lot of people sort of toss around. You talk about BMW. Daimler finally found a partner again. You know, obviously Lexus has that big corporate parent that can decide, you know, what they need to do. That always seems to be the vulnerability that BMW has as regulation increases. There's 6 different technologies competing right now.
Yeah,
it might be the winner.
Yeah.
You wonder, do you run the risk of actually starting to fall behind because you don't have that partner? I mean, you think you, when you say you want to maintain your independence, you think that's such a firm goal that that will be the case, or is there, you know, some growing awareness that there might be a need for help?
No, I think, Jeff, that is the case as a company. And as far as partnerships, we're always open to partnerships. You know, and you mentioned Daimler, I would just say is, you know, just a couple of days ago, we announced, you know, we're going to be doing joint purchasing of seat frames with Daimler, and we do some other kinds of things right now. We've worked with Peugeot on the development of an engine, which is in the Mini, and it's in Peugeot. So as far as partnering with people where it makes sense to jointly develop technologies, either to have access to technologies or to spread cost bases, the company isn't dogmatic. It's very pragmatic. But as far as, you know, the company itself, and we're fortunate enough to have one very large shareholder in the Quant family, and so that gives us stability to be able to continue as well, too, which is really important.
So you're on the search for a new marketing person for BMW?
Well, Jack has moved on now, or he will in September, and Jack will become the vice president of our Northeast region, and we will be filling that position, and we hope to have that all finished and announced by the time September comes around. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. 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 Do you have any good candidates you'd like to kind of talk about here?
Maybe after.
After, okay.
Hey, we talked about diesels earlier.
Yeah, I heard that. That was a great conversation.
BMW's bringing diesels back into the American market. Yeah. How's that going? And what do you think of what Tim Manganiello is saying here?
In fact, I made a little note when you guys, because I thought that was a great subject. Well, I'll tell you how we see it, and we're now in our second model year with two diesels in the market, the 335D and the X535D. We have a great desire to see diesels grow in America, and I think that's in combination with our other colleagues in the other German companies as well. So we're all really pushing diesel. I mean, you know, we're getting into this market in a big way. Volkswagen's done a great job. Remember before you were talking about Audis, you know, in the market very well. Mercedes has been. I mean, they're of the Europeans. They're the diesel progenitors of the species here in America. So it's good. But we've seen a couple of things. One is we are now watching from a regulatory standpoint a softening and an opening up to listening of the potential. Which is something I think, Peter, you were mentioning before. That wasn't there a couple years ago when we started.
And now, who are you talking about? You know, California in particular, the CARB?
Yes.
California Air Resources,
and also the EPA? And also the EPA.
Actually, EPA has been, U.S. EPA has been very pro-diesel from the get-go.
And there's a listening to that. And I think maybe part of that comes from the fact that today, as you guys had talked before, is we've got the toughest diesel regulations in the world right now. I mean, when you take we're meeting it. Right. And everybody else
but
who's selling right now.
At extraordinary cost. And when you can say instantly
and that's the
that
third part.
Diesel will instantly cut CO2 emissions 25% and do it at a lower cost than just about anything, it's like, why don't we back off? And it's NOx emission standards that are really killing the diesel in terms of adding cost.
Yeah.
That if we would just back off a little bit, and this is what I don't get. You know, why can't we just match what Europe has?
You know, what I think you're going to see, though, is Europe, if our standards don't continue to toughen, I mean, if they kind of stay where they are, within a couple of years, when you start to see Euro 5 come in, you're going to see the European standards come up to where we are today.
They are, Tom, but at that point, the cost will have been taken out or dramatically reduced.
Or spread, because you're
so
going to be
we, as a
more or less the
just
same.
Say, and I'm this is a rhetorical question to you. Why don't we just say, hey, let's get to this NOx level, but let's work with industry and figure out what the cost is, and why don't we just plan it out of getting there in a few years longer? We're still going to get there, but let's just do it over a longer period of time. And as we get better and better at reducing this NOx emissions, we'll do it at much lower cost.
Yeah.
Or the volume will come up where
that would require an energy policy. Yeah. That was
sorry, Jeff, I forgot.
You guys handled the politics here tonight.
Well, I mean, it is. You think about it. What happened was, by the way we regulate diesel, you took away a bridge from gasoline to, you know, hybrids. By making diesels as expensive as a hybrid, it is kind of crazy. If you could have let diesel be that bridge and go to and some diesel hybrids and use that as a bridge toward that technology, it would have made a lot more sense. But if you've got to urea filters and all the different things you got to do to get the NOx out. It was a chilling factor. A lot of people didn't even bother to bring diesels. Yeah. The interesting thing for me, which
but we see some rays of light though.
Well, and I was just going to say, every time I go to the gas station now, I see a diesel pump. Just about every, Meijer has a
They're
diesel
everywhere.
Pump at every one of their locations as they add new pumps. That was the biggest problem we had. You know, where's the diesel pump that I'm going to go to? And now I'm always. Almost every time I fill up, I find myself at the diesel pump.
Well, the good thing, just think about this though. The good thing for us, and I think the other European manufacturers in the premium side of the business, is we sell the majority of our products in urban markets. And if you look at urban markets, most of the urban markets are pretty well stocked with diesel because of supplies coming into urban markets then too. You know, big trucks with diesels, and then the stations have had to have pumps. So if you're buying a Mercedes or an Audi or a BMW diesel and you live in a large city, you're probably not going to have a difficult time finding diesel. You know, whenever I drive one here, I'll go, a quarter of a mile more.
Big deal.
Big deal, exactly. Anyway, back to the point you guys are making, your logic trail is absolutely right. I do think that from the policymaker standpoint, we're starting to see a walk to some of that same logic trail.
How do you
trail.
See that? How, you know, yeah, just in conversations, how would you give us more concrete evidence that you see a change?
Well, I hope you'll see some of that reflected. We'll see in September, but we're going to have, I think September or in that time period, we're going to see the first cut at 2017 to 2025 CAFE and CO2 regulations. You know, we're already locked on 2012 to 2016. And there's been a lot of conversation, and I would say, you know, with a great deal of compliments to the administration, they have asked us a lot for comments, what our thinking is on that, which we haven't seen in past administrations. And that's not a political statement. It's a statement of, you know, the policy side of the administration. And we've seen a lot of that. And so I think we've all felt very good as we've been able to kind of throw in those kinds of things. Let's hope we see some of that reflected in what the first cut looks like for the 2017 to 2025 period.
Jeff, you brought a good point up. CAFE doesn't constitute an energy policy.
Right.
And this country woefully lacks.
Yeah. That's right.
We've
just been watching this for 90 days in newspapers. You know?
It's Pollyanna because it's telling people you need to make your buyers adopt a habit that clearly, based on, look at where the sales are going, trucks almost passed cars in July again. I mean, we've completely lost that whole cars are going to, you know, trucks are dead thing. You can't get to those CAFE numbers with the mix where it is. I mean, at least I don't know of a way with what the plans are that you see out there. With the mix as it is right now, it's fantasy that we're going to get to CAFE based on buyers' habits without some kind of intervention. And there is no political will for an intervention. So we're all just fooling ourselves. And I mean, so you penalize the automakers. It just becomes a tax on the automakers for not making numbers that you know nobody wants. It's not a policy.
Sales numbers for hybrids right now, mighty weak, mighty weak.
What's the percentage right now?
A percentage of the market?
Yeah. It's been hovering around 2.5 the last year.
It's probably about 2.5%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and we're talking 36,000 volts and 20-some thousand leafs. You know, that's what the annual output of a Zuzu or something. I mean, it's invisible.
It really is.
Isn't it time for...
It is time. It is time for Ben to bring up the graphic. It's time to get to rapid fire. Okay, Tom, this is where we go through comments and questions from our viewers. And we try to keep the answers fairly short just so we can get to... a whole bunch of them. So first one, Mike D. White says, why does Europe get the new X3 before us? It's built here.
That's true. Next question. How's that for a rapid fire answer? It's pretty close. It's very close. What we've done, I mean, and the answer behind that, you know, sometimes we get some things more quickly as well, too. But we build in batches to satisfy, you know, putting vehicles into the whole dealership network first. And so this time we just are building a batch with the European regulations to the X3, and then they'll go to ours. But we're right behind that. It's literally a month.
George writes in to say, one of the issues that has not been mentioned about electric vehicles is that if you do not drive them 12,000 miles or more a year, the batteries will deteriorate from age. So you never get your money's worth out of the car. With a traditional car, you don't have this problem. I've never heard that the batteries would deteriorate.
I don't know if anyone's had an electric car for a year.
I don't know if anyone's been able to put that many miles on one.
We have a Mini-E lessor who has put 32,000 miles on his Mini.
Yowza.
In a year. You know, because the lease period was for 1 year. And how he got 32,000 miles.
Well, he lived in the car. Every second it wasn't recharging.
But it's amazing. He had 32,000 miles on it.
Comment from Electro Drive. He says, 2 years ago, Volvo wrote about an electric motor on each wheel and a small diesel to charge the battery after 100 kilometers. Yeah, that's their. They've got an electric version of the C30. That is a really terrific-looking car, actually. And they do have hub motors in that thing.
Mm-hmm.
George from Brooklyn says, what about taxes on diesel? I don't know, diesel fuel or diesel engine?
You guys would take a cut. I've got a comment on taxes as well.
I mean, part of that is it's a big truck issue. I mean, we tax diesel for a specific reason that doesn't necessarily reflect the non-commercial use of it, and because it's not that significant yet.
There's actually two sets of taxes on diesel. One is a national tax, and that's six cents a gallon. And that's exactly for that reason, Jeff. It's it was put there 30 years ago, in a sense, for road maintenance and repair.
Give me a rebate if I'm using it for non-commercial.
And then there is a variable tax state by state. So you go into some states, and today you'll find, and this is, I think, another problem we see in the market with diesel, is that there's not a consistency in gas prices, but there's a greater variance in diesel prices state to state. So you'll go into some states that carry solely the 6 cents premium, and then the state tax, there's very little, if any, state tax. You go into other states, and I think the highest one last time we looked was like 23 cents. So, you know, you can have a variance of 6 cents plus 23 cents, so now you're 30 cents above gasoline in some states. So it varies a lot.
That is a lot. Hey, we get a lot of phone calls coming in, too, and Ben, why don't we bring in the first caller?
Hey, Don, this is Rick from San Diego. Hey, on that diesel thing, I agree that if we use the European standards, we'd be fine. I mean, these people that say it's going to create all these medical issues, I don't see the Europeans having that many problems. I mean, they should be dropping like flies over there if you believe the story they're trying to tell.
And they're all on vacation.
And, as far as that wall in California, make sure you have a west-east wall just north of L.A., because you can have those guys up north. They're for sale if you want them.
Good point.
Thanks.
It's all the smoking in Europe inoculates them from the diesel fumes.
Well, that's a great point that he makes, because if we were to adapt Europe's emission standards for diesels, it's not like people would be clutching their throats and choking and dying. It wouldn't be. In fact, I don't even think we could measure the difference.
And diesel is 50% or something of the fleet there, and it's a long time before it's 50% of the fleet here.
Yeah, that's true.
George from Brooklyn wants to know, what does the panel think of GM flirting with mild hybrids again, which is a topic you brought up?
I don't know why they didn't do it in the first place. I mean, when Tom Stevens explained what next-gen mild hybrids were going to do, I looked at that and said, just forget hybrids altogether and just do that. Just throw that better battery pack, the improved start-stop generator on all their vehicles, and it's way better bang for the buck than anything they were going to do with two-mode or a true hybrid. It just seems like a really, what are they saying, like a $1,300, $1,000 premium, a third of what you're going to get. I just think that totally made sense, and it is good to see they're thinking about it. I think it was more, they just couldn't afford it. I mean, they're the big proponent of it, and Honda. And Toyota did a really good job of making it seem stupid. You know, I mean, and that was what happens to all these technologies. There's proponents and enemies, and the enemies tend to, you know, show up and kill things. And I think that was
cost and just, you know, bad image. You're not really doing a hybrid when you do a mild hybrid.
BMW is going to have stop-start technology, isn't it?
Yeah, we do in Europe.
In Europe.
It's part of the whole suite of efficient dynamics technologies, and we have it on a lot of cars in Europe and a sizable part of our fleet in Europe, and it will come here.
My understanding, too, is that in the EPA driving cycle, there is no stoplight or stop sign time.
Right.
So you don't get any credit for a stop-start technology, i.e. in terms of boosting your CAFE number.
Exactly right. You don't get to enjoy on the EPA test cycle the real-world benefit of stop-start.
Michael Weber saw how Amy Marentick was here last week, and he said, John, this week the boys show off their legs. So I guess we should all show off our legs. No, we're not going to do that. Youngblood from Cleveland, Ohio says, what was the mindset or lack thereof behind dumping the ultimate driving machine and substituting joy?
I'm glad you asked that question because we didn't dump the ultimate driving machine. If you take a look at every BMW ad you see and every signature, the ultimate driving machine is still there. And I can understand where some of the confusion came from, and we've tried to address it oftentimes. But there is no dumping the ultimate driving machine, and we would have to be kind of the ultimate guys that have been out to lunch for a long time if we were to do that, and so we're not.
But why have two taglines? Isn't that confusing?
Didn't joy originate from Germany and...
Well, yes and no, Peter, because they were our colleagues in Germany were looking for something that could be used around the world. And, you know, an ultimate driving machine is not used around the world, which is really kind of interesting. And they were looking for something that kind of signified...
Which would go in China and...
And an emotion to the brand.
Right.
You know, an ultimate driving machine, yes, we think that's very emotional, but in other markets, obviously it wasn't because it's not being used there. So the whole idea of joy is compatible with the ultimate driving machine because if you have it, what goes on your face is a smile of joy. So that's the whole idea where the joy. I think as we go along and people will start to see that ultimate driving machine isn't going away and joy is there with it and we are using that and quite frankly maybe today and we can all Monday morning quarterback this. Maybe today with joy it was a bit more emphasis on joy at the beginning and ultimate driving machine, but they're coming nicely in balance again too. If you heard Jim's speech yesterday, I think we had ultimate driving machine in there 14.7 times just to make sure you didn't forget about it yesterday. So it was there in droves.
Okay.
Well, and maybe all automakers should be limited to one-word taglines because there's a lot less stupidity out there. Joy, love, will just, everybody goes to one word. Yeah, and we're
But for everybody else, it's changing them every year. I would look at this as a positive, is that kind of the furor around ultimate driving machine does show that, after 30 years, you can build a constituency of knowledge and warmth and support around that, and oftentimes I kind of wonder why companies change them every year and a half.
Just guys over at Chevrolet are wondering,
Hey, let's bring in another phone call here, Ben.
Hey, guys. It's Frank from Bridgeton, New Jersey. I read David Walsh's little column today about GM investigating a new midsize pickup, and again, David, you fall into the same trap of everybody of, well, we just decontent the big trucks and they cost the same as the small trucks. That's not the concern. The issue is some of us like small, compact trucks. Why do you think the Ranger, which is probably, 30 years old now, still sells? We like small trucks. Not all of us need to tow 6,000 pounds. We don't all need 6-liter V8s or 800 foot-pound torque diesels. We like small trucks. I've given up even thinking about getting a small diesel, but a small four-cylinder with a five-speed, that's what we like, something around the size of the Ranger. So it's not about big trucks costing less. I realize it costs money to make these smaller trucks. Build them in Mexico. We build everything else there to make it cheap. If Ford can build a Fiesta there and make money, they can build a small Ranger there and make money as well. Keep up the good work, guys.
Well, and I mean, since Dave is not here to defend his
story. Yeah, you're here to defend it.
That's kind of what they're talking about is let's look at one of the global truck platforms, and those are all smaller. They're not canyon size.
and see whether that would work here. I mean, they make some, you know, go down, drive the Montana. It's not really a truck, but that size truck they have down in Brazil. Or I've not driven the stuff they make in Indonesia, but they have a platform elsewhere in the world that is much more like the old S10 and like the Ranger still is. And, I mean, that may be, I think that's the bigger problem, is all these, you know, small pickup trucks are just a smidge below where the big pickup trucks are, and there isn't a lot of room there. But to go for a true sort of world pickup truck.
Well, the viewer's got a great point because, I mean, Ford has tried to kill off the Ranger forever. I don't think GM really wanted to do the Canyon or the Cheyenne. It's just that there was demand for it. And, you know, the dealers don't really like it because they want to talk the customer up into the bigger pickup and make a bigger margin on it. But he's got a good point. A lot of people like small trucks. And the only ones who I think really take it seriously are Toyota with the Tacoma. They sell a bunch of them. And Nissan with the Frontier. And I think it shows because their big trucks are absolute fiascos in the marketplace from a sales standpoint. Let's see. George wrote in to say, ask your guest if he knows about the car BMW created that would recapture heat energy in the exhaust and from the radiator. Why'd they stop work on it? I think it was called the Turbo Steamer or something like that.
Well, actually, we haven't.
Stopped work on it.
We haven't stopped work on it. It's one of the technologies that we have been mining out of, you know, other areas of industry. And we are doing a lot of work right now on capturing exhaust gas and then using that, you know, for other accessories inside the car and other electrical needs inside the car as a way of saving.
But I think you guys have a second project. This one was actually converting steam to run a turbo to boost the engine. And then there's another one that BMW is working on that uses a chemical process to convert heat into electricity.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's the one that you're talking about.
That's the one I'm talking about, yeah.
And then and it doesn't do a lot, you know, 5% of the energy needs, but enough to run the radio, the headlamps,
exactly.
Maybe the AC and stuff.
And that's
like
the whole idea about this whole box of technologies under efficient dynamics, which is 5% here, 5% there. Pretty soon that's 10%. That's not a new engine. It's just maximizing the technologies and what's available, too. So that's what we're doing. This one, I'm not aware of this one. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I think they called it the Turbo Steamer. And very interesting. There's an SAE paper out on it and the like. Let's bring in another call here, Ben.
Hi, this is Steve in Port Washington, Wisconsin. I was wondering why Mini always comes in with low quality ratings and how the parent company, BMW, could allow such a thing. Thank you.
Good direct question.
Very good direct question. Where I think we get a lot of that is in the J.D. Power IQS, because that's where Mini generally comes below. And if you're aware of the J.D. Power IQS rankings, they talk about mechanical issues of a car, and then they talk about design issues of a car. And Mini has had its problems, I will say, has had its problems on the design issue ratings, which all roll up into the J.D. Power IQS. And it has been a point that Mini has known for years. For example, the radio knob is not in a place in a Mini where if you get into the car for the first time in that first 90 days of ownership where, you know, you fill out the survey, it's generally something that you're comfortable with. You know, I mean, it's the point. But that's the reason why Mini has this uniqueness to it. And, you know, it's there. We know it. We continue to work on those things. We've improved those things. In 2011, we made more changes now to the 2011 Mini coming up. Some more of that will start to become a little bit more standardized where, you know, you're used to it in other cars. You'll start to see it Minis. And as we go through other generations, you'll see that. But it is one of those things that, you know, I wish it were easy enough to say it's black and white. We know what they all are and we can fix them. I think we do. But the point is sometimes there is a feeling inside, and I think among our owners, you know, we depend also a lot on our Mini owners for their feedback, is there's a uniqueness about the car, too, that once they get used to it, it's something that becomes part of the uniqueness of the car. These things are difficult because they're not black and white issues. You know, if something breaks, you fix it. Yeah, we do that. But on these kinds of things, they oftentimes are things that you say, okay, I know what the consequences are, but for that uniqueness, I'm going to live with those consequences.
Well, we should ask that question again when David Welch is here, since he's a mini owner, and
he can balance that out.
We got another question, another phone call here. Ben, let's bring that in.
Hi, John. Enjoying the show. This is Warren Webb from the Studebaker Ranch here in Paris, California. I'd like to comment and get your opinion there or views on a Chrysler show car that I had seen probably about 10 years ago that had the hub motors, and I believe it was powered by a 16-horse diesel generator that was under the hood. And that was pretty much along the lines of what you were describing there earlier with this company with the hub motors. I'm wondering if you or any of the other guests there remember that and get an opinion. Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Yeah, I don't remember that at all.
Mm-hmm. But hub motors have been around a long time.
In fact, the first car that Ferdinand Porsche ever designed, what they call the Lohr Porsche, I think I'm saying that pronounced
Lohner,
that right.
Lohner?
Lohner Porsche was a hub and motor car. And so, yeah, the concept is not at all new whatsoever. In fact, probably Da Vinci had something up his sleeve along those lines. But the difference now is in the size and weight of these things. Because obviously, if you bolt a motor to the wheel, you've just added on so much unsprung weight, which really adversely affects the handling. Now, if, on the other hand, you're able to get rid of the differential, the drive shaft, the axle shafts, you've actually lightened it in the rear. In the front, you still have more weight, and that's where you don't want it because you're steering through those things, too. The other thing is, in the one that I was talking about earlier that I saw this week, was its modular design and how it could be assembled with very simple automation. So that kind of is the new wrinkle is these motors just keep getting smaller and lighter and more efficient and easier to make, and that's what's intriguing about them.
You know, something that would be interesting for everybody tuning in tonight from their comments would be if we take a look at a lot of where the alternative propulsion vehicles are going, and Jeff, I think you mentioned what's five or six different technologies that are out there right now. Is the perception is that we're going to give up the pleasure of driving if we go into these? Because it's something that we think about a lot. I mean, and it's our intent not to. But I would be very interested to hear whether it's the impression that people have, which is, I don't want electric vehicles, not because they're electric, it's because there is a pleasure of driving that we all really indulge in that we may have to give up. It'd just be interesting to hear how people think about that.
I think it's out there, definitely, among the enthusiast community.
It was kind of interesting because Mark Royce is tweeting about driving the Volt around a week or two ago.
I just saw him the other day on Woodward with the Volt.
And I mean, it was almost like, you know, he's like, it's like driving a car, you know. And I mean, there is that expectation. And when you get in a Volt, if you don't know it's a Volt, you'd be talking about this car you're driving. I mean, okay, it's quieter maybe, but I mean, not necessarily. There's wind noise. I mean, there's a different quality to it, but they're doing a better job of making gasoline cars quiet. It's more of the anxiety, you know. And I mean, they're making a big deal about range anxiety now. I mean, everybody's, you know, going after the Leaf. Oh, you know, I've driven 40 miles and now I know I've got 300 to go. If I were in a Leaf, I'd have to turn around. I mean, so it's the different technologies trashing their competing technologies is as much of a problem as anything else. But it gives that impression. Oh, you know, if you drive an E85 car, it'll smell like cooking oil. You drive a diesel, you're gonna choke. You know, I mean, it comes from the people who support the other technologies, and everybody pays for that.
And they start. And sometimes I wish, you know, in the marketing side of the auto business, we could spread perception as well as other people spread perception. Sometimes, on the Mini, we have, you know, we've been lucky enough to have 450 people living with them for a year, and range anxiety has not generally been a big problem. People are really right now with the first generation of the early adopters of electric vehicles are finding if you can give me 100 to 110 miles day in and day out, weather conditions be damned, you know, just day in, day out, 100 to 110 miles, I don't have range anxiety. Because most trips of people who are buying electric vehicles are within that range. You know, it's driving to and from work. And in Europe, we have, we have close to 100 people. And what we've done in the studies there, we've done a lot of research there, is where you live closer, is they're only plugging in every third day. So that whole thing, now, what the big challenge is to get the consistency of that 100 and some miles. And with the Mini, we didn't have that because of temperature extremes. When we come now with the new BMW Active E next summer, which will be based off the 1 Series, we'll have battery heaters, which will maintain a constant temperature of the batteries, which is where you lose that consistency, you know, where the batteries either heat up or cool down too much. You want to keep them within an operating range. So once I think we start to work down these, we're not kind of counting on the 300-mile battery yet. We wish it were out there, but it doesn't seem to be on the horizon right now.
When I have range anxiety,
we just want to be consistent.
Every 6 days in my pickup because I've forgotten to put gas in it and I don't have time. I mean, whatever, you're always going to be pushing your vehicle to.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think you've got to be careful evaluating these early adopters who are, you know, EV fanatics who are, you know, going to have the best situation. I buy what you're saying, that, you know, if people could have a consistent 100-mile and it would recharge fairly easily and they had a place to recharge it and all that, that range anxiety will go away. But I think part of the real objections on my and many other people's part to EVs is not the EVs themselves. I'm something of an EV fanatic or enthusiast, certainly. But it's this, the government choosing that this is going to be the winner and we're going to just throw stupid money at it. Stupid money to the point where we're giving car companies that have never, ever built a car in their lives
lots of money, billions.
Hundreds of millions.
Yes.
And that's
when
I go, you know, this isn't fair, this isn't right, because even though I think EVs are cool, and in fact, I may be in the market for one fairly soon, I think diesels are really cool. And in fact, I've got an Audi Q7 out here that I've been test driving that is just sensational. And so I think that's where a lot of the objection comes from is, well, you know, how come these guys get to pick what the winner is? They, you know, what makes
GM
them
had
so
that
smart?
Sort of, they were, when they were sort of bashing Bush for his lack of energy policy, they were literally saying, okay, we have, you know, E85 for this market, diesel for this market, you know, hybrids where it makes sense, put in a plug-in vehicle here. I mean, they had those five symbols that they had for all of the different technologies as an idea. And, you know, they got laughed at because the they weren't seen as a technology leader. But that's sort of the problem you have is you know, so there's 50,000 electric vehicles, 300,000 diesel vehicles. Most of the fleet goes to mild hybrid. It starts to make a difference. If you're going to pick a winner, you're right. We have 7 battery plants in Michigan, the capacity for 10 times the expected demand going online in 2012. I mean, it could be a really embarrassing flop that sets us all back.
I think we should get comfortable with the fact is that for the foreseeable future, there may not be a winner, and that's a good thing because people with various lifestyles, people in different geographies may get better benefit, and we all will have better benefit in terms of more efficiency because the vehicles used will be the best vehicles for the job, is to allow choice and to stimulate the market for choice, not for, as you say, a winner or a loser.
Well,
we believe in that a lot.
My wife has a 100-year-old aunt, and we have roughly the same birthday, so we're celebrating our birthday. She turned 100, and I turned much less than that. She said, you know, you do the car thing, right? When I was a kid, there were steam cars, there were electric cars, there were all these cars, and gasoline won. So what's changed? Because gasoline was what made sense for, you know, 80 years of my life, and now I see, you know, and, you know, I said, you know, really, nothing. nothing real has yet changed. I mean, gasoline still wins. I mean, it's still the smartest. We haven't yet to fix the whole gasoline thing. It's still the cheapest, easiest way to move a car around.
Well, 20 years from now, we're still going to have, depending on who you talk to, 80 to 85% of vehicles' internal combustion.
Yeah.
It's not going to change radically.
That's right. Well, look, we've gone a little bit longer than we normally do, but that was good. It was well worth doing it. But Tom Kowaleski, thanks so much for coming in. Great having you here on AutoLine After Hours. Jeff Green from Bloomberg, great having you here as well.
I couldn't think of any literary quotes to make to drop in, a.k.a. Moby Dick or Shakespeare, that David normally has. So I apologize.
Well, we'll have you back. You work on that, and we'll definitely
maybe some
have
Ayn Rand or something I can work on.
That can work, too. And Peter, as always, it's always good having the auto extremist here.
Glad to be here,
it's
John.
Terrific.
Thanks.
And thanks, everybody, for having joined us today. Remember, you can always follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/outofline Detroit or Twitter, twitter.com/outofline. You can read Peter's rants and raves and everything else that he's got on his website at autoextremist.com. You can follow him at twitter.com/autoextremist. You can always get Jeff Green's stuff at Bloomberg.com.
Or
right?
Businessweek.com.
Or Businessweek.com.
We're all one big happy family.
And Tom, anybody can go to just BMW.com to read up on everything
BMW.
And anything.
BMW.com. And you're also welcome to come into BMWUSANews.com or MiniUSANews.com. That's our two media sites, but they're not password protected, so... Anybody? We have all of our videos, speeches, photography, everything up on there, too.
Remember, you can always listen to our programs on your BlackBerry or smartphone via Stitcher. Just go to our website and follow the little icon there. It will walk you through it. And remember, we're doing in 2 weeks the Autoline After Hours Dream Cruise on Wednesday, not Thursday night, Wednesday, August 18th from 6 to 8 p.m. But thanks, everybody, for having tuned in. Visit our website, outofline Detroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with Autoline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at outofline Detroit.tv.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Passion for excellence. Change of frequency with you.
Hypnotize the color of eyes. Mr. BMW guy, here's your answer. This is Youngblood in Cleveland calling. They're not going to take away my joy in driving, and they're not going to take away my high-performance car. If they do, I'm going to fire up the 650-horse Camaro, come up to Detroit there, pick Peter up, and we're going to have Vanishing Point. 21st century version. Later. Ain't going to happen,
except
buddy.
He dies
drive
at
on
the end.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
This is typical when I always think about when you get involved in social media.